So we're looking at that passage, Exodus 29, verse 38, through to Exodus 30, verse 10. And the passage begins, "Now this is what you shall offer on the altar, two lambs a year old, day by day, regularly." Regularly there is perhaps better translated continually. I mean, by definition, something that happens day by day is regular. That doesn't need to be said. But the point is that these offerings, they won't happen day by day for a week, say. The way that a bull was to be sacrificed on seven consecutive days in order to consecrate the altar. Remember, we saw that last week in chapter 29, verses 36 and 37. No, these offerings were to happen day by day, always, without stopping, continually. That's what that last word in verse 38 is getting at. So we're dealing here then with the bread and butter, if you like, of tabernacle sacrifices. Of course, other sacrifices occurred at different times and for different reasons, but the basic staple routine that carried on whatever else was happening, whatever point of the month or year it might be, was this: the morning sacrifice and the evening sacrifice. The morning sacrifice and the evening sacrifice. The morning sacrifice and the evening sacrifice. Day after day after day after day. And for a few minutes then, I want us to think first about these daily offerings in their Sinai form, that is, simply as they are here in our text. And then I want us to think secondly about these daily offerings and their subsequent focus, that is, how, as the Bible unfolds, they gradually take on a different emphasis. So first of all then, these daily offerings in their Sinai form. Now you might at this point be thinking a couple of things. You might be thinking, number one, that in terms of the text here, there isn't much to say about these daily offerings. One lamb is to be sacrificed in the morning, along with some mixed flour and oil and some wine. Exactly the same is to be sacrificed in the evening, and that then pretty much sums it up. And then you might be thinking, number two, that the text contains this other phenomenon, the burning of incense, there in chapter 30, verses 1 to 10, which in my preoccupation with these daily offerings, I seem to be completely ignoring. Well, let me clarify something here, which actually answers both of those points. Something quite important for understanding this morning's passage, and it's this. The burning of incense, there in chapter 30, isn't really a separate tabernacle ritual that just happens to come up next as God outlines everything to Moses, so that there's the daily offerings and there's the burning of incense. No, the burning of incense is part of the daily offerings. It has no intrinsic self-standing significance. Rather, it has significance insofar as it belongs with the daily offerings. I mean, you can see very easily in the text that there's a close relationship between these two activities, the daily offerings and the burning of incense. For one thing, both the daily offerings and the burning of incense involve altars. Similar altars, indeed. The altar for the daily offerings was described, you remember, at the start of chapter 27. The altar for the burning of incense is described here in chapter 30, verses 1 to 5. Both are made of acacia wood. Both are square. Both feature these sticky out bits that the text calls horns. So they are similar altars. For another thing, the daily offerings and the burning of incense are connected by pieces of shared vocabulary. Chapter 29, verse 42 says of the daily offering, "It shall be a regular," that's that word again that I said is better continual, "it shall be a continual burnt offering throughout your generations." And chapter 30, verse 8 says of the burning of incense that a regular, same word, incense offering before the Lord throughout your generations. So you can see that identical language is used in both cases. And then one more thing, and this is particularly key. The daily offerings and the burning of incense happen simultaneously. We've already commented when the daily offerings occur, chapter 29, verse 39, one lamb you shall offer in the morning, and the other lamb you shall offer at twilight, when does the burning of incense occur? Chapter 30, verses 7 and 8. Every morning when he dresses the lamps, he shall burn it. And then the next verse, when he sets up the lamps at twilight, he shall burn it, morning and evening. So in all these ways, I'm saying, a close relationship between these two tabernacle activities is evident. And just before I explain exactly what that relationship is, something else about the burning of incense ought to be noted. Not this time something that it has in common with the daily offering, something distinctive, the way in which it takes place almost in the inner chamber, the most holy place that's particularly associated with God's presence. Now, technically, the altar on which the incense is burned isn't in there. It's in the holy place rather than the most holy place. But look at the language of chapter 30, verse 6. You shall put it, that's the altar for burning incense, you shall put it in front of the veil that is above the ark of the testimony, in front of the mercy seat that is above the testimony where I will meet with you. So that sounds as though it's kind of right up against that fabric partition. And of course, incense isn't static, is it? It moves, it wafts. And if its starting point then is so close to the most holy place, then unquestionably it's going to fill that inner chamber, that inner sanctuary, before you can say Jack Robinson. That's why a later description of the altar of incense in 1 Kings 6:22 refers to it as belonging to the inner sanctuary. Not because it was actually positioned in the inner sanctuary. We know the pieces of furniture that were in the inner sanctuary. We looked at those a few weeks ago. But because it emitted its thick, aromatic cloud through the veil directly and unerringly into the inner sanctuary. So, we have then the daily offerings and the burning of incense. And both involve altars. Altars that are similar. And both are described with the same kind of vocabulary in our passage. And both occur at the same time, in the morning and in the evening. But then alongside all these things in common with the daily offerings, the burning of incense also has this distinctive feature, we said. It's very much in God's face, if we may say that reverently. Encroaching on that part of the tabernacle that is most profoundly God's dwelling. What's going on then? What's all this about? Well, think about it. Every morning, you have out in the tabernacle courtyard this bronze altar. And it's a bit weather-beaten and a bit stained by burn marks and animal blood and a bit scratched by the repeated use of metal utensils on it. And on the altar are lumps of lamb's flesh getting blacker and blacker as they are literally being burnt to a cinder. And it isn't a particularly elegant, refined kind of scene then. It's rough and ready. It's noisy. It's messy. There's little that's attractive about it. And as that scene unfolds out there in the tabernacle courtyard, you have at the same time, right in the bowels of the tabernacle, this other altar. And it's gleaming. Every millimeter of its pure gold veneer is gleaming. And on this altar, there's just a bowl of liquid, a flame, and an ascending cloud of perfumey fragrance. And it's so elegant and so refined, a thing of exquisite beauty. And several hours later, it's evening, and it's the same. Outside in the courtyard, the shabby altar with its frazzled lumps of meat. Near to God's presence, the luminous altar with its delightful aroma emanating. And the point being made is this. The luminous altar with its delightful aroma represents how God receives and how God perceives what's been offered to him out there in the courtyard. He doesn't see it as a shabby altar with its frazzled lumps of meat. He doesn't see it as inelegant and unrefined and unattractive. He sees it as splendid and delectable. In his perception, it's not a scene of rusty bronze and burning flesh. It's a scene of sparkling gold and fragrant incense. I'm saying the burning of incense is the daily offerings from God's viewpoint. The burning of incense shows how he regards the daily offerings. It denotes his intense pleasure in them. We might say that by the time the offering of those lambs in the courtyard has reached God's presence in the inner sanctuary, it has converted into incense, which he breathes in with great contentment and appreciation. That is the point being made. So I hope you understand all that. But just one further thing to clarify before we move on. Remember, I talked last week about the Old Testament offerings carrying different meanings. They can signify atonement. They can signify dedication to God. They can signify communion with God, and so on, we said. But what about these lambs then that were sacrificed every day? Well, remember I said that there's overlap between the different types of offerings. I think we can infer actually from Hebrews 5 verse 1 that all the Old Testament offerings to some extent at least signified atonement. And so it's there in the case of these daily offerings of the lambs. Also, these lambs are burnt offerings. Notice they're called that in chapter 6 verse 42. Nothing of them is left over. So there's that suggestion of total dedication to God here. But notice the verses about the daily offerings flow kind of seamlessly into those last verses of chapter 29, verses 42 to 46, where the emphasis is on God's presence in the tabernacle, the sheer fact that by means of that tabernacle, God dwells among his people. And the implication seems to be that the daily offerings are really, when you strip everything else away, they are really just a response to that. They are simply Israel's daily recognition of the daily reality of God's presence among them. They are an expression of wonder, love, and praise in the face of this staggering truth that God is in our midst. There's nothing more complicated to them, really, than that. They are straightforward praise. The daily offerings, I'm saying, are praise. And that, then, is what God perceives as fragrant incense emanating from a pure golden altar. Really, it's happening on that rusty old altar out in the courtyard, but God, we said a moment ago, perceives it as this beautiful, fragrant thing. And what it is then that really he's perceiving as this beautiful, fragrant thing is praise, simply praise. And having established that then, we're ready to move on to our second point this morning. We've considered these daily offerings in their Sinai form. Now, secondly, we must consider these daily offerings and their subsequent focus. These daily offerings and their subsequent focus. So I've just said then the daily offerings, they're really about praise. Not so much atonement or dedication or communion. Praise is the leading emphasis here. But that requires some mental gymnastics on our part, doesn't it? What I mean is, if you hear the word praise, I very much doubt that the mental image which comes to your head is of lambs being sacrificed on a big bronze altar. Rather, the mental image that comes into your head is probably of a congregation standing and singing exuberantly to God, or perhaps sitting with its eyes closed in prayer, something like that. Well, what I want to show you now is that as the Bible continues, and as the daily offerings continue to crop up quite often in the Bible, there's a definite, discernible shift of emphasis takes place toward what you and I would recognize as praise. I'm going to take you on a brief biblical tour. And our first port of call then is 1 Chronicles chapter 16. 1 Chronicles chapter 16. Now, we know, don't we, that in David's era, and here we are being teleported into David's era, we know that in David's era there was one very significant evolution in Israel's tabernacle worship. It ceased being in a tabernacle. That tent structure of the tabernacle was replaced by a proper, solid building. I know Solomon actually brought that to fruition, but of course it was really David's project. So there was that very significant, very attention-grabbing evolution. But there were others too that you can easily fail to notice. Look at verse 4 of 1 Chronicles 16. And it begins then he, that is David, appointed some of the Levites as ministers before the Ark of the Lord. That sounds fairly unremarkable. But then it goes on to specify the kind of ministering that's in view here. To minister as ministers before the Ark of the Lord, to invoke, to thank, and to praise the Lord, the God of Israel. Asaph was the chief, and second to him was Zechariah, Jael, Shemiramoth, Jehiel, Mattithiah, Eliab, Benaiah, Obed-Edom, and Jael, who were to play harps and lyres. Asaph was to sound the cymbals, and Benaiah and Jehaziel, the priests, were to blow trumpets regularly before the Ark of the Covenant of God. Then on that day, David first appointed that thanksgiving be sung to the Lord by Asaph and his brothers. Verses 8 to 36 then give us the content of this sung praise by the Levites. But this is the thing. When was this kind of singing to be carried out by these Levites? Just on special occasions, once in a blue moon? Well, look at verse 37. Where we read, so David left Asaph and his brothers there before the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord to minister regularly before the Ark as each day required. That's to minister in the way that has just been described in the preceding section, to minister through singing all this material that has just been given us there. He left them to minister in that way as each day required. And the fact then that it's each day, and the fact that that key word regularly or continually from our passage crops up again there in verse 37, it strongly implies, I think, that this sung praise accompanied the daily offerings. The daily offerings, which by the way are then immediately mentioned in verse 40 of that same chapter. So there's a strong implication there, but then just move over a few more pages to 1 Chronicles 23, verses 28 to 30. 1 Chronicles 23, 28 to 30. And here the duties of the Levites are spelled out. And we read verse 28, their duty was to assist the sons of Aaron for the service of the house of the Lord, having the care of the courts and the chambers, the cleansing of all that is holy, and any work for the service of the house of God. Their duty was also to assist with the showbread, the flour for the grain offering, the wafers of unleavened bread, the baked offering, the offering mixed with oil, and all measures of quantity or size. And they were to stand every morning thanking and praising the Lord, and likewise at evening. Now that can only be talking about during the morning and evening sacrifices. Indeed, notice verse 31 continues, and whenever burnt offerings were offered to the Lord. So, in other words, when they were offered every morning and evening burnt offerings, then this praise was to accompany them, and whenever else burnt offerings were also offered. So what's strongly implied then in chapter 16 now becomes explicit in chapter 23. This singing, this praising, this praying, it accompanied the daily offerings. Next text is Psalm 5, verse 3. Psalm 5. Verse 3, where The psalmist says, O Lord, in the morning you hear my voice. In the morning I prepare a sacrifice for you and watch. Now, in the interest of transparency, I need to point out that the word sacrifice is not there in the Hebrew text. And some of the English translations have something else instead of sacrifice. But the verb prepare is normally used in connection with preparing a sacrifice. And I think that there's good reason, therefore, for the ESV to go with that word. Now, of course, the psalmist doesn't literally prepare a sacrifice in the morning, because the priests prepare the sacrifices there at the tabernacle, but they do so on behalf of the people. That's the point. And the psalmist is saying then that as that happens, as the morning sacrifice, which the priests are preparing on his behalf, as that takes place, he raises his voice. You hear my voice, first half of the verse. He raises his voice in prayer, in praise. In other words, what we're seeing here in Psalm 5 then is that it wasn't just the Levites who accompanied the daily offerings in this way with praise and prayer. But individual Israelites did it too. Because the psalmist here is saying that I raise my voice as the morning and evening sacrifices are offered. By the way, when he says, I prepare sacrifice for you and watch, he's not talking there about literally watching the sacrifice. He may be at the in the tabernacle courtyard, or he may be just in his own residence and praying at the same time as the sacrifice has been offered. But he's not talking about watching literally there. He means watch in the sense that the Psalms often use that word, watch for the answers to my prayers. That's what he means there. But the point I'm making is that the psalmist, as an individual, not just the Levites, the psalmist, he's also, with the morning sacrifice, with the evening sacrifice, he's offering praise and prayer to God. Psalm 141, verse 2. Psalm 141, verse 2. The psalmist says, let my prayer be counted as incense before you, and the lifting up of my hands as the evening sacrifice. So, apart from anything else, this confirms our interpretation of our passage in Exodus, that the evening sacrifice, and presumably the morning sacrifice as well, counted as incense before God. The incense and the sacrifice aren't two separate rituals, but they go together. It's the sacrifice in the courtyard that's been perceived in the eyes of God as incense. But notice here, the psalmist wants his lifting up of his hands, that in the Bible is a posture for intercession. He wants his prayer, his intercession, to be kind of coupled with the evening sacrifice, to ride on the coattails of the evening sacrifice, and just as the evening sacrifice, to also be considered as incense before God. We'll go now into more familiar territory. New Testament, Luke chapter 1. And verses 8 to 10. Passage that's perhaps usually read at a particular time of year. And we have there then Luke saying, while he was serving as priest, this is Zechariah, the father of John the Baptist, before God, when his division was on duty, according to the custom of the priesthood, he was chosen by lot to enter the temple of the Lord and burn incense. So he goes in then to the temple, that is into the holy place, in order to be the priest who burns the incense on the special golden altar. And Luke then goes on to tell us that outside in the courtyard, as this is happening, the daily offerings have been burnt, the lambs have been burnt on the altar. Well, no, he doesn't tell us that actually. Presumably that was happening. But that's not what Luke tells us is going on outside in the courtyard. What does he say? Verse 10, and the whole multitude of the people were praying outside at the hour of incense. And so he shows no interest, Luke, here in telling us about the lambs being burnt and those being perceived as incense by God, but rather the people are praying. And presumably that's what's been regarded as incense by God. Or the other end of Luke's gospel, Luke chapter 24, verses 52 and 53, the very closing remarks of the whole gospel. where we read of Jesus then blessing the disciples, then he parted from them, was carried up into heaven. Verse 52, and they worshipped him and returned to Jerusalem with great joy and were continually in the temple blessing God. So the disciples, after Jesus' ascension to heaven, are continually in the temple blessing God. What are they doing exactly? Well, almost certainly they are attending the morning and the evening sacrifices. The word continually there in verse 53, in the Greek it's diapantos, literally through everything. And in the Greek version of Numbers 28, that phrase diapantos is used repeatedly in connection with the daily offerings to translate that word we've commented on several times, regularly, continually. So it's not an incidental word that Luke uses here. And so these disciples were attending the morning and the evening sacrifices, not because they were especially bothered about the lambs being offered on the bronze altar, but we're told what they were wanting to do during the morning and evening sacrifices: bless God. Bless God. Prayer, prayer and praise. And then Acts chapter 3. Not too many stops left on our tour. Acts chapter 3, verse 1. Luke again says, Peter and John were going up to the temple at the hour of prayer, the ninth hour. And almost certainly this refers to the same thing then. This is the disciples still doing what Luke told us at the end of his gospel they were doing. And they're going up at the time of the evening sacrifice, according to Josephus. During this period, the morning sacrifice took place at the third hour, so that's 9 o'clock in the morning. The evening sacrifice took place at the ninth hour, so 3 in the afternoon. It might not seem very much evening to us, but that's when the evening sacrifice apparently took place during this period. And so when Luke says here that they were going up to the temple at the ninth hour, they were definitely going at the time when the evening sacrifice was being performed. And yet now the lambs on that bronze altar are so far from the focus that it's even called now the hour of prayer. It's not even called here by Luke the hour of sacrifice or the hour of offering, but the hour of prayer. And so, stepping back then, you see what has happened between our passage in Exodus and Acts chapter 3. The sacrifice of lambs, which God originally received as incense, has gradually faded from view, and it's prayer and praise from the mouths of his people that God receives as incense. And I want to impress upon you then, as we close this morning, that God receives our prayer and praise as incense. And in that connection, two final texts in the latter part of the New Testament, which make, I think, particularly significant contributions to our theme this morning. First of all, Revelation chapter 8, verses 3 and 4. So this is, of course, John seeing these visions. And I read from verse 1, when the Lamb opened the seventh seal. We talked about the seals, we sang about the seals earlier. There was silence in heaven for about half an hour. Then I saw the seven angels who stand before God, and seven trumpets were given to them. And another angel came and stood at the altar with a golden censer. And he was given much incense to offer with the prayers of all the saints on the golden altar before the throne. And the smoke of the incense with the prayers of the saints rose before God from the hand of the angel. And you see then that the prayers of the saints here are connected with incense. It was also actually in chapter 5. We sang in our opening praise this morning. We sang of the prayers rising as incense, because it's mentioned there in chapter 5 as well. And the significant contribution then of this text is that now the divorce from the lambs being offered on that bronze altar is complete. The divorce now is complete. The lambs are now nowhere in view whatsoever. I mean, in the previous text, all the previous texts that we've just been through, the prayer and praise that was taking place had to do with the tabernacle, the temple, and the lambs were presumably still being offered at the same time. But here, the lambs being offered on the bronze altar, that's irrelevant now. That's just floated completely into the ether. Here we've been shown the true tabernacle, the true temple in heaven, where an angel, not a son of Aaron, an angel is at the altar of incense, burning the incense. And I want you to see then, and I want you to appreciate this morning, that our prayers and our praises look like, smell like, are perceived as incense by God as they rise to him. I mean, it is so much like what we were saying earlier about the tabernacle, isn't it? We said that there's this kind of disconnect between the shabby bronze altar, so rusty, so marked, so unimpressive out there in the courtyard, and you wouldn't look at it twice, and the way that God is perceiving it as this golden altar and this fragrant incense coming from it. And isn't that precisely that disconnect in our praying and praising? Don't we look at our prayers and they just look so unimpressive? We can barely string two sentences together often. And we feel that we're getting nowhere. We're banging our head against the wall and we're speaking words that are bouncing off the ceilings. And we think, well, what good have I done? I've spent 10 minutes, 20 minutes, half an hour in prayer. What good have I done? Have I communicated at all with God? Is the ruler of the universe going to be remotely interested in what I've just said? I'm barely interested in it myself. It's so pathetic. Is God going to be remotely interested in it? And Revelation 8 is saying to us, this is how God perceives our prayers and praises. As this incense coming from an altar of gold. He values it. He treasures it. He sees beauty in that which has no real objective intrinsic beauty. He sees it as beautiful. This past week, Hannah's mum sent her a video which she'd found of Talitha and Fraser when they were much younger. Fraser was just a baby and really just sitting on the floor of his grandparents' living room clutching his teddy, and Talitha was prattling away, not really sure entirely what she was talking about, and Fraser was grunting, but there we were kind of straining our ears to listen to exactly what Talitha was saying and exactly what Fraser was grunting. Why? They weren't saying anything eloquent or particularly meaningful, but because they matter to us and we love them. And that's the point that this is making, that here are these prayers of the saints and their grunts and their sighs, and they're pathetic, but they matter to God because he loves us. And they're incense as they arrive in his presence. The other text, I said there were two particularly significant ones. The other one is Hebrews chapter 13. And it's verses 15 and 16. Where we read, through him, that is through Jesus, then let us continually offer up a sacrifice of praise to God, that is the fruit of lips that acknowledge his name. And again, then we have that Greek phrase, diapantos, continually. Again, the Greek translation I said of that Hebrew word, regularly, continually, it's in our passage. So connecting this to the daily offerings. And again then here, we're divorced now from the whole temple thing, aren't we? I mean, the last thing this writer wants to do is encourage his readers to think about going back to the temple. They're too much enamored with going in that direction anyway. He's not talking here about the literal morning and evening sacrifices going on in the temple in Jerusalem. No, the sacrifice here is exclusively, solely praise to God, verse 15. Continually offer up a sacrifice of praise to God. That's what the incense is. Like in Revelation 8, the incense here, the thing which God perceives as beautiful and fragrant, is this praising God, these lips that acknowledge his name. But I said there's a significant contribution here, and the significant contribution here is that in verse 16, the scope is broadened actually here beyond just prayer and praise. Because he continues, do not neglect to do good and to share what you have, for such sacrifices are pleasing to God. So there's prayer and praise in verse 15, the fruit of lips that acknowledge his name. That's what we're doing here. We're acknowledging God's name on the Lord's Day. That's prayer and praise. But then verse 16 is what we're doing Monday to Saturday. It's doing good, sharing what we have. And that too, the writer is saying, is perceived by God as beautiful, fragrant incense. Paul makes a similar point, doesn't he, in Philippians 4. Epaphroditus has brought those gifts from the Philippian believers to him in jail, and he says it's like a fragrant, sweet-smelling offering. Again, using sacrificial language. And again, we look at our Christian lives and we think they're so useless, so pathetic. What we do for Jesus is so pitiful. And yet, the wonderful thing is that even offering a cup of water, Jesus said, in his name, is perceived by God as beautiful fragrance emanating from a golden altar. It's especially remarkable actually there in Hebrews 13 when the writer goes on to tell us in verse 21. Because look, notice in verse 16 he said that these sacrifices are pleasing to God. That's the incense idea, isn't it? God finds them pleasing and beautiful and like incense. And he uses that same phrase, pleasing, in verse 21. But there it's a prayer that God will equip the saints with everything good, that they may do his will, working in us, God working in us that which is pleasing in his sight. And so it's the idea, you know how you might, with a young child, you might bake a cake with them or something. And really, you're the adult, are doing everything. They're doing virtually nothing. There might be a little bit of stirring. Even then, you're holding the spoon with them and helping them to stir. The child does virtually nothing. You're the one baking the cake. And yet, when you sit down and eat the cake afterwards, you rave over it and say, oh, this is marvelous. You're going to be a wonderful baker one day. And that's kind of the picture here. That these works, these acts of service in our lives, it's actually God's doing in us. He produces it in us. And yet, he then finds it pleasing in his sight. And he says, that's wonderful, child. That's fragrance in my nostrils. And so I'm saying this morning, be encouraged. Be encouraged that in prayer and praising God, individually, corporate times like this, be encouraged in your Christian lives generally, what is done for God, what is done for Jesus, is perceived by God, not fault-findingly, not critically, not harshly. You need to do that better, son. But as incense arising from a golden altar. Everything I want to say is really summed up in some words with which I close from the great Samuel Rutherford, who said this: God's children rise many times off their knees from prayer with a woe heart, a sad heart, thinking that because they have no feeling, that God is offended with their prayers and thinks little of their works. Whereas, Rutherford says, their prayers and tears and works are accepted before God. You think nothing of one tear, Rutherford says, yet God puts it in his bottle. And nothing of one sigh, but God gathers it in his treasure. If God thought of us as the world does, and as we think of ourselves, woeful would our case be. But God has not a pleasanter sight in the world than the face of a child of God. Amen.